Penguin Random House Audio presents Astral Weeks, A Secret History of 1968 by Ryan H. Walsh. Read for you by Stephen Hoy. Prologue. In the beginning. You know this story. At the 1965 Newport Folk Festival, 23-year-old singer, songwriter, and future Nobel laureate Bob Dylan defiantly led his band through a decibel-pushing, distortion-heavy electric set, including Maggie's Farm and Like a Rolling Stone, shocking folk purists. If I had an axe, I'd chop the microphone cable right now, Pete Seeger grumbled. Fans booed, organizers were aghast, and Dylan had turned himself into someone else. It's one of the true culture-shifting moments in rock and roll history. But what else happened that night? Though other acts followed Dylan, the evening was enveloped by a confused, mournful feeling. The festival was now a funeral. One musician was so upset by Dylan's set that he performed an unscheduled coda. On the empty, unlit Newport stage, a skinny 27-year-old harmonica player named Mel Lyman closed out the proceedings. I wanted to save the world with music. I still do, but I was more naive at that time, Lyman told a reporter in 1971. I kept having this fucking recurring image in my sleep of playing Rock of Ages. Every night I'd toss around in bed. I'd say, don't make me do it, don't make me do it. Finally I said, okay, if it's gotta be done, I'll do it. Lyman was at Newport as part of Jim Queskin's jug band, but their performance had ended long before Dylan's heretical set. As crowds streamed toward the exit, Lyman pushed out a eulogy through his instrument. I played Rock of Ages. The people heard it as they were leaving, but it was more for the musicians than the people, Lyman explained. The musicians were spellbound. They were hearing what they should have been doing. Some of the musicians were crying. I was told that later. I must have lost 10 pounds during that song. The sweat was just pouring down. The spirit was so strong I could barely get it out. You know, the harmonica. That's a pretty tiny hole for all that spirit to go through. That little tiny reed. According to some reports, his rendition of Rock of Ages went on for half an hour. Within 18 months of this performance, Mel Lyman would commandeer an entire neighborhood of run-down houses in the Fort Hill area of Roxbury, an impoverished part of Boston, issue cuss-laden pronouncements through an influential underground newspaper, and declare he was God to anyone who would listen. By early 1968, more than 100 people lived with Mel in his Fort Hill community. Their stated goal was ever-changing and hard to pin down, but on several occasions, Lyman family members spoke to the press about creating the most beautiful music the world has ever known, and it seemed that they were hell-bent on making this music in a style that was in direct opposition to Dylan's Newport act. The Lymans rejected electric instruments, embracing traditional American folk stylings as a way to transform their lives. The most beautiful music the world has ever known. Some of the music that emerged from Fort Hill was certainly lovely, but this story starts with a man who undeniably made good on a similar ambition, at the same time and in the same place. He came to the idea himself, by way of a dream. In early 1968, 7 miles from Mel Lyman's Fort Hill community and across the Charles River, a 21-year-old Van Morrison had just found himself the holder of a lease for an apartment on Green Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was about to make a masterpiece. Born in 1945 in Belfast, Ireland, George Ivan Morrison started writing poetry as a child, before I knew what poetry was. His father's vast record collection, acquired during a trip to the States, introduced Van to the mysterious world of American blues through artists like Leadbelly and Jelly Roll Morton. Beginning his music career as a teenager, he played saxophone and guitar for several acts before finding acclaim as the frontman of R&B act Them, who first toured America in 1966. A stint at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Los Angeles led to the band jamming with Jim Morrison, sharing a bill with Captain Beefheart, and despite a 50% alcohol discount, running up a $2,600 tab. Another anecdote involved Van borrowing a guitar, smashing it on stage, then casually telling the sobbing ex-axe owner, "That's art, man." On June 23rd, Them appeared in San Francisco, where Morrison met Janet Rigsby, a 19-year-old Bay Area model and aspiring actress. "I looked at him, he looked at me, and it was alchemical whammo," she said. "I had never been to a rock concert before. We really connected in a very spiritual way, so we tried to spend as much time together as we could while he was touring up and down California." One night he would perform well, and the next night he would just glower at the audience, Them guitarist Jim Armstrong recalled. Between shows, Morrison was putting together the lyrics for Ballerina, an ode to Janet, and one of the first pieces of Astral Weeks to be written. When Them's work visas were not extended, the band returned to Ireland, where Van abruptly left the group. He spent part of his tour earnings on a reel-to-reel tape recorder, planted it at his parents' house, and laid down countless hours of song ideas. He pined for Janet, trying to figure out what would come next. Described by one biographer as reeking of Paul Mall's cheap cologne and hit records, producer Burt Burns was no one's idea of a savior, but in 1967, Van Morrison wasn't in a position to be choosy. Burns had been the first American producer to work with Them. Morrison had been immediately enamored when he learned that Burns had written "I Don't Want to Go On Without You" for the Drifters. Burns introduced Them to Overdubs and a song of his called "Here Comes the Night." Their version went to number 2 in the United Kingdom and number 24 in the United States. Burns could have attached himself to one of the several post-Morrison versions of Them, but he knew to bet on the talented but currently aimless singer. Burns hoped that Morrison could become a rock and roll version of the Irish poet Brendan Behan, a unique vision, to say the least. He offered $2,500 to sign a contract that a desperate Morrison barely reviewed. Arriving in New York in 1967, Morrison was puzzled by what he found in the studio. "I showed up for the session, and 40 people are there," he later explained to a Warner Brothers executive. "4 guitar players, 4 keyboard players, 5 singers, 4 entire rhythm sections. It was bizarre." In banter heard before one outtake, Morrison wishes it could be freer, remarking, "At the minute, we have a choke thing going. Know what I mean?" No one did. One photo reveals an exhausted Morrison, head in his hands. Burt Burns was calling most of the shots at these sessions. He changed the lyrics and title of "Brown-Skinned Girl" at the last minute to the version we all know so well today. When Morrison was finally allowed to lay down TB sheets in the style and arrangement he was comfortable with, he ended up sobbing in the vocal booth. "He was just torn apart," engineer Brooks Arthur recalled. "He was sitting on the floor in a heap like a wrung-out dishcloth, completely spent emotionally." After 2 days, Burns sent him back to Belfast. The producer would bring Morrison back to the States only if one of the songs became a hit. The singer told Janet that if she heard him on the radio, it meant he was on his way to find her. Luckily, Brown-Eyed Girl spent 16 weeks.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?